Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. You're with Bruce DeTorres and World Stage on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
World Stage indeed, exposing the tyrannies and exploring our power with deep dives into history, current events, dangerous trends, and the nature of reality. 9/11 woke me up. I dug deep into the reality of that evidence and had my mind blown back in 2004. And after 10 years of research, conceived a book wrapped in the best spiritual imagination that I had developed to that point and still maintain as a truth that sets us free. My book is God School, 9/11 and JFK. And I was published by Chris Milligan at Trine Day and was invited to help him with a weekly podcast and then do other marketing for him. And now I am Trine Day's marketing director. And among the many researchers, authors, investigative journalists, and other experts that Chris Milligan has published at Trine Day is my guest this hour, John Loftus, who is a former U.S. government prosecutor, a former Army intelligence officer, and the author of many books, including America's Nazi Secret. And this is the subtitle of America's Nazi Secret, an insider's history of how the United States Department of Justice obstructed Congress by blocking congressional investigations into famous American families who funded Hitler, Stalin, and Arab terrorists, lying to Congress, the GAO, and the CIA about the post-war immigration of Eastern European Nazi war criminals to the U.S., and concealing from the 9/11 investigators the role of the Arab Nazi war criminals in recruiting modern Middle Eastern terrorist groups. John has appeared regularly as a media commentator on ABC National Radio and Fox News. His other books are The Secret War Against the Jews, Unholy Trinity, How the Vatican's Nazi Networks Betrayed Western Intelligence to the Soviets, and Unholy Trinity, The Vatican, the Nazis, and the Swiss Banks. John, it's an honor to have you here. How are you today?
Doing pretty well. How you doing, Bruce?
Good, John. I appreciate your time tremendously. And we've got a luxurious amount of time here in three segments. And I was thinking that in chronological order, your work for the Department of Justice and what you discovered there, and then a very natural unfolding of all that you found. And I'll interject and comment and ask questions along the way. And we can certainly go off on any and all tangents that come up at any time, but as a basic framework, how's that for collaborating on this on the show today?
Sounds good.
Well, thank you. So again, you know, young man, how did you get to work at the Department of Justice or become a prosecutor and all that?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I was disabled, and they said I got to have 3 years of grad school. So I signed up for graduate school at night and law school during the day, and completed both with honors. And I applied to become a law clerk for the Attorney General of the United States. And, you know, about 40,000 people apply, and I was one of a couple of dozen that were selected. So I moved to Washington and got my top secret clearances, and it was fun. The first 2 years I worked on appellate cases in the Supreme Court. I wrote briefs with Solicitor General. And apparently I impressed some of the guys in the Solicitor General's article. I was commended by the Supreme Court for confessing error in the case. So anyway, the guy that hired me was Alan Ryan, and he was assigned to a guy who had been one of the Nuremberg prosecutors. And so I was the first line attorney that was hired for the new office of special investigations. This was established by Congress to check into all these stories coming out that Jewish survivors in America were seeing Nazi war criminals walking around the streets. So, you know, I thought it might be a nice trip to Germany or something, you know, go to Oktoberfest. But because of my security and intelligence backgrounds, I was the guy assigned to work with the American intelligence agencies to see if there might be any clues in our files as to where there might be Nazis hiding in America. And so instead of getting to go to Germany, I got to go to Suitland, Maryland. A nice little town right outside Washington, D.C. And that's where America's secrets are buried, literally. There are 20 vaults underground. Each vault is 1 acre in size. If you've ever seen the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, the last scene of that movie is what the underground vaults are really like. Only not as organized as they were in the movie. But when I was down there, people would come up to me and say, I know what you're doing. Don't tell my boss, but you got to go look at these files. And I had to have my security clearances upgraded several levels. I had to get a Q clearance for nuclear weapons and a cosmic clearance for NATO top secrets. And I went into the vaults in the Q cage with the nuclear weapon things. That's where the Nazi files are hidden. And discovered to my horror that the British government and the British Secret Service in particular, after World War II, had dumped their Nazi war criminals in America, and we were covering it up. The reason this happened is that the Russian intelligence services had penetrated the British intelligence community, top to bottom. And the British were trying to sell us these anti-communist groups that, you know, they had fought with the Nazis during the war, but they really weren't Nazis. They were anti-communist freedom fighters. And we've checked all their backgrounds. Well, the people doing the background checks were folks by the name of Kim Philby, Donald McLean, and others. And these were part of what was called the Cambridge Five, the group of five Cambridge University students who were communist double agents within the British Secret Intelligence Service. And they were the ones that peddled all these communist-riddled Eastern European Nazi groups, and they sold them to the ever-gullible U.S. State Department. You got to remember that the Democrats were in power in the early stages when this was going on, but these white-wing wingnuts in America were so confident that Dewey was going to win the 48 elections, they went ahead and were bringing the Nazis in behind Truman's back without him knowing it. And then when Dewey got reelected, they were in trouble. I mean, you know, technically they committed mutiny. They'd given
when Truman got reelected.
Yeah, when Truman got reelected, yeah, Dewey was defeated. But Alan Dulles, whom Dewey had promised would be the first head of CIA, was now in a world of trouble because, you know, the war was still on with Germany, remember. We hadn't signed any peace treaties yet. So technically, giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war is treason under the U.S. Constitution. So a lot of these Republican right-wingers were in a very tough place. So they had Nazis in America, and they were desperately trying to find ways to protect themselves. So in 48, they got a law passed saying they could bring in 100 ineligibles, Nazi war criminals, a year, because they were essential to U.S. security. And they were bringing in guys like the head of the Ukrainian police service and the head of the Belarusian police service. And these guys were war criminals, but they were also Soviet double agents. So what they were doing is right from the beginning, U.S. intelligence was wrecked because of this mutiny that's committed by the Dulles brothers. Alan Dulles, then under Eisenhower, 4 years later, he became head of CIA finally. And his brother, John Foster Dulles, became Eisenhower's Secretary of State. So within the Republican Party, we had this group run by the Dulles brothers who were protecting who? Well, Wall Street investors, the guys that had put their money to fund Hitler. And, you know, people like the Rockefellers. So they were a rogue group within the right wing of the Republican Party, and they ended up helping the communists. And that was how the communists blackmailed their way into U.S. intelligence. For example, our code breakers discovered that within the Justice Department's Bureau of FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, two agents in the New York, New Jersey area were communists. And, you know, Richard Sullivan, the deputy director, went to J. Edgar Hoover and said, look, we've got two communist agents wearing FBI uniforms in this, you know, major field office, the largest in the country. We need an investigation. And Hoover said, no. If you start an investigation, you know, the press will find out about it. He said, well, why don't we transfer people out two by two to other things until we find out who the two Soviet agents were? And the transmissions will stop. And Hoover said, no, don't do that. The press might find out. So J. Edgar Hoover let two communist agents remain inside one of the most sensitive offices of the FBI. This was the place where they did the background checks for refugees arriving in America. You can imagine all the Nazi war criminals coming through New York and New Jersey. They got sterling recommendations. You know, a lot of them were discovered and arrested anyway, but the FBI kept letting them go. The FBI basically was piggybacking on the British/Nazi spies coming in, because they were spying on other agencies that employed them. For example, SS General Kuschel told the FBI, he was one of their confidential informants, that he was watching other Belarusian Nazis recruit paratroopers to be sent behind the Iron Curtain as spies. And they were up in Canada. There's a lot of people don't realize that most of the Nazi war criminals couldn't get into America originally because the American intelligence blocked them, but they sure got into Canada. It's really sad, but Canada became a dumping ground for Nazis the way that Argentina and Brazil were later on. So the Americans were using double agents like Kuschel to recruit agents behind the Iron Curtain. And Kuschel, of course, was betraying the names and the dates of the parachute operations over to the Russians. The CIA officers later reported in a highly classified file that we had a 98% casualty rate for agents that we sent behind the Iron Curtain. So they really betrayed U.S. intelligence from top to bottom during the Cold War. Major scandal for the Republican Party. Eisenhower's in office. The Dulles brothers are, you know, running the show for him. And all of a sudden, they're finding out that all of their, you know, supposed right-wing recruits are really red-wing recruits. They're really working for the Kremlin. They've covered
well, it would have been a scandal. It didn't come out at that time, right?
No, it didn't come out, and that's right. The tragedy. When Eisenhower was elected, the Dulles brothers censored U.S. intelligence. They literally shredded some of the CIA's files and the Pentagon's files. I was very lucky, and I had two great sources that knew about all this. And one, Dan Benjamin, was the sort of senior Army Counterintelligence Corps guy for the Soviet Union. And his wife, Anne, had been a professional officer in the Secret Intelligence Service. She ran the archives in Germany after the war. So she was one of Britain's top Nazi experts, and he was one of America's top communist experts. Two of them together, they dug out a lot. They discovered how the Dulles brothers had hidden their recruits away, because they had a bunch of American corporations that kept offices, corporate offices, in the Third Reich during the war.
John, that's a perfect point to segue into a little break that we have to take, and we'll be back shortly to further develop this earth-shaking information that you found deep in the bowels of files that no one was ever supposed to see again, but you found them over 40 years ago and have been writing ever since. My guest is John Loftus. We're talking about America's Nazi Secret, one of his great books, and the deep info he dug out years ago. And we'll be back after a little break. And this is TNT Radio.
Rick Munn on TNT Radio.
You might be thinking, well, what's the big deal? It's only a few trees. No, it's not only a few trees. It's part of what made Plymouth what it was in a certain area. Those trees were growing for decades upon decades. They were part of the fixtures and fittings of Plymouth city centre, and now they've all been lopped down under cover of darkness. And they're not only doing it in Plymouth, but I've had a lot of guests on that are commenting that in their towns and cities, the councils have been out with the chainsaws at night cutting down trees. A good friend of mine, Johnny Fisher, who listens into the show, he wrote to his local councillor, there's a huge tree right outside his apartment, and the council wrote to him to say they're going to cut it down. And he said, why? What's wrong with it? It's beautiful. It's superb. It's wonderful. No, we have to cut it down. It's blocking this and it's doing that. There's a big 5G mast right beside it, by the way. I don't know if that's got anything to do with it, but they're very handy with the chainsaws these days, and it's not enough to destroy human life. It's not enough to attack us with mRNA technology, but now they want to lop down trees, and they're attacking animals, and chickens are being culled, and you know, they want to inject them as well. It's almost like these globalists literally hit the planet, not just us.
Rick Munn is locked and loaded on today's News Talk TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Bruce Tataris, and my guest is John Loftus, L-O-F as in Frank, T-U-S, talking about what he discovered when he worked for the Department of Justice way back, in, I think, in the 1970s. John, that's right. That's when this was happening, right?
Yeah. I was main justice. I worked from 77 to 81.
Right. And I want to just recap my understanding. What you've just shared is you were tasked with investigating allegations that were Nazi war criminals here in the United States. And you were steered surreptitiously by folks who knew what you were doing and wanted you to really find the real dirt. And you found files on Nazis imported into the United States that were hidden among nuclear files so that they would never ever, these files would not be found. And you found how Republican cliques in the State Department under Harry Truman's first term, we'll call it, aided secretly and got these war criminals basically approved to come into the United States. I was going to say smuggled, but with approval. And then you were describing how the Dulles brothers facilitated this, and you had just gotten to the point of alluding to, well, why, what the Dulles brothers had been doing, why they were interested in how this was covering their own butt. So I thought you could definitely conclude your thought of that you were at that point, or maybe back up and describe what the Dulles brothers did during the 30s and during the 40s on behalf of what companies helping the development of Nazi Germany and helping Hitler wage the war, and describing that was the Dulles brothers' great motivation to burying these realities.
You know, the Dulles brothers are probably the two most villainous individuals in American history. I don't know how else to put it. It's Allen stayed with the State Department longer than John Foster did, but they were both descended of another right-wing State Department head, Secretary of State. In the 20s, Allen was ordered by the State Department to cover up the Armenian genocide because we wanted to make nice with the Turks. We wanted their oil. And Allen wrote in his top secret file, I can do it, but it's going to be difficult because there's so much evidence. In other words, so much evidence implicating the Turks as the ones responsible for the genocide of the Armenian minorities. So Dulles was, bad from the beginning. Now, America had a real funny president named Roosevelt, not Franklin Roosevelt, but the other one, Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy had passed a series of laws against monopolies and cartels. And this was making life difficult for what they call the robber barons of Wall Street. So in 1918, they passed a loophole law in Congress called the Webb-Pomeroy Act to allow Americans to establish monopolies, trusts, and cartels overseas. And so the Dulles brothers had their clients, who were the robber barons, move their money out of America into places like Tsarist Russia, which had just been taken over by the Bolsheviks, who were funding the Bolsheviks. They moved it into Nazi Germany. They moved it into what was become Saudi Arabia. So it was covert ops to buy up countries that would allow them to establish cartels.
Because the Dulles brothers were Wall Street's most powerful, or among the most powerful, corporate lawyers for these giant money interests in America.
Firms, right. The law firm Sullivan and Cromwell, handled Wall Street. I mean, and these guys were looking for a safe place to make more money now that monopolies were banned in America. So the Great Depression of the 1920s was because a lot of Wall Street's money went overseas to the Dulles brothers' clients. So the Dulles brothers were responsible for cloaking these investments to make sure that, if America ever went to war with any of their clients, that their clients wouldn't lose their money. And we knew that there were companies, the Ford, Rockefeller, the DuPonts. There's even a handful of Democrats. There was the Harriman family of New York and Joseph Kennedy, JFK's dad. Who were investing in the Nazi stocks as well. What they don't know is that guys like Joe Kennedy were buying the Nazi stocks from Prescott Bush.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the same ship going to Germany together. So there was this little incestuous investment club of right-wingers who thought that the Nazis were just fine. And they funded Hitler knowing that he might be the guy that would keep the unions at bay. One of the guys actually wrote a book in Germany called I Finance Hitler. And it's like, how much he regretted doing that. But we had this whole network of British and American investors who were the financial rescue team that rescued Germany after World War I.
Did they invest an equivalent amount in this in the early Soviet Union through those years too?
Yeah, the Harrimans in particular. The Soviet Union could not get a hold of gold, so they were illegally sending gold bullion to Russia, and then of course we had the Koch brothers came in and rescued Stalin's oil industry. Yeah, the right-wingers were the guys that saved the Bolshevik Revolution.
Thank you. I just wanted to see if, I knew it was kind of equivalent with what they were doing, building up Germany at the same time. Well, yep, not building up Germany, investing in businesses there to make money doing it. And along the way, this Nazi party played along with them.
Right. What happened was, for example, in Russia, the czarist economy permitted cartels and monopolies. So they'd originally gone to Russia because of the czarist businesses. The Dulles brothers had clients in the Nobel Oil Company. And the Bolshevik Revolution meant that they were losing money. Their oil stocks were worthless because the Russians had taken over. But business is business, you know. So they, some people like the Koch brothers, they traded with all sides. And the same with Nazi Germany. So a lot of the arms manufacturers in Nazi Germany were funded with American money.
And
the, it was a laundry.
Alan Dulles was...
Yes. Alan Dulles hid the crime.
Right. As the, you know, these lawyers, these Dulleses, and with the, by the late 20s, I think the Bank of International Settlements was set up in Switzerland, and that was facilitating that money flow, right?
Yeah. See, when Hitler came to power, he knew that the Allied nations were the ones that were really controlling the money in Germany. So he quickly passed a law that no Western company could own stock in a German company. So what happened then is the Dulles brothers had German banks own the stock of the German companies, and then Swiss
was banks that a was that stock. A was that a was that a rebellious move by Hitler against these Westerners who had helped set
he didn't want Germany to be controlled by the Dulles brothers.
Well, that must have been quite a stinging slap in the face, because my understanding is that one or both of the Dulleses were in Berlin at the meeting where Hitler was negotiating as chancellor more power, I think, from the then president Hindenburg. Do you know about that? Can you?
Oh yeah, early on, you know, there were a lot of people, including the Vatican, that thought that, you know, Hitler would just be dandy. And not realizing that Hitler was just going to throw them out in their butts when they got in.
So he outlawed Western to consolidate
Western
into...
The Dulles brothers then had German banks own the stock of the German corporations and Swiss banks own the stocks of the German banks. So, you know, but when Hitler invaded Poland, he discovered that, oh my God, you know, these industrial bases like the Auschwitz-Birkenau complex, which was originally started as a joint industrial processing plant with Stalin, that was secretly owned by the Americans. Birkenau was to take coal from the Polish coal deposits in Silesia and transform it into coal tires, which could become additives to make aviation gasoline. And Stalin, in return, would ship raw material like magnesium so that the Dulles clients in Germany could make steel. Stalin even dug canals to link the Auschwitz site to the Vistula River so they could bring in the raw materials by barge. And, you know, so people don't realize that Auschwitz was originally built by American and British investors. And they had proxy companies set up to hide their profit-making during the war. So Stalin supplied the slave labor of the former Jews. But these guys, Auschwitz was just a profit center to them. So that was something that had to be covered up.
Definitely. And and then after 41, Hitler invades the Soviet Union. But as far as the American assistance still flowing to Hitler in 42, 43, that was robust. That was many companies. The Dulleses were helping those companies and helping those efforts, as were Brown Brothers Harriman and Prescott Bush and people like those.
Yeah, and the evidence for that is in Switzerland. Switzerland was really a financial entity controlled by the British and American investors. And I think something like almost 40% of Hitler's war materials came through Switzerland. Switzerland laundered the Western supplies that he needed to fight the war.
Where did he get those supplies?
Well, the Americans and British, we kept supplying oil to the Germans.
Right. All right.
Yeah.
And
the Rockefellers were busted, by the way. The Attorney General, I think it was in 42, raided the Rockefeller, the Chase, Southern Oil, and found, you know, you guys are helping the Nazis. And the Rockefeller says, oh, we'll pay a token fine, but don't bother us again. Because if you do, you will get no oil for D-Day. And so the Justice Department backed up. Now, the British were going wild because they had wiretapped all these people. There was a former Supreme Court justice who was one of my sources. And he was in one of the offices of American intelligence in the Empire State Building on the floor below the Dulles' headquarters. And he was bugging them, and the British were on the floor above. So they knew what was happening. They knew that, you know, during World War II, there were American corporate officials who were on the wrong side of the war. But the British had their own problems as well, because they had King Edward VII, I guess, he was a Nazi agent. He was recruited by an American Nazi woman. And the British knew they had to get rid of the guy. He was selling all the British secrets. All the British secrets went directly to Berlin. And so after the king succeeded, but before he was inaugurated, I guess, on the throne, the British told him he had to resign. So that's why they made up the story about he resigned to marry the woman he loved. He resigned because he was going to be hung as a traitor. I found his files in there. Attorney General's office. You know, the British were begging us, you know, not to ever mention that, you know, the nice old king was actually a Nazi war criminal. And J. Edgar Hoover said, no, this guy is such a dangerous Nazi agent. We should keep him and Mr. Simpson in a prison for the rest of the war, not let them run around on an island the way the British wanted. I think it's no wonder Queen Elizabeth gave a knighthood to the guy that was a scriptwriter for the Crown. I mean, he really covered this up.
Yeah. Well, and you also found what I think is the incredible story of Naval Officer Richard Nixon. If you want to jump into that part of the story.
Yeah, Captain Nixon was assigned to the Brooklyn Navy Yard reviewing captured German records. And his were from the maritime days. Well, he found out that there was this, you know, German company, the one that built the Bismarck and a lot of other ships, that was owned by this Dutch bank that was owned by a bank in New York, okay? And the head of that bank was one of the Bushes, who worked for the Dulles Brothers clients. So Captain Nixon then took the files to the Dulles Brothers and said, I'll make you trade. You know, you get me elected to Congress, and I'll make sure these files don't see the light of day. So that was how Nixon got the money from Wall Street to run against a wizard named Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was elected to Congress. And also,
I think in 1946, his original run, he was against an incumbent, and then 2 years later, maybe it was Ms. Douglas.
Oh, was it? Okay, thank you. I couldn't quite remember. I wasn't sure that. But anyway,
it puts the lie to Nixon's legacy. Oh, I saw an ad in my district in California, and so I applied Republican businessman.
Right. So by helping the Dulles Brothers cover up the thing, then Nixon became senator, and Eisenhower was forced to take him as his vice president.
So in 1952,
And that was when everything started to go to pieces, that, the Nazis in America were being uncovered. Philby and company, the British guys, were forced to flee behind the Iron Curtain to escape prosecution. So it was really a time when the Eisenhower administration had to cover up for Nixon's mistakes. But Nixon liked this because he saw the Nazi immigrants from Eastern Europe as a counterweight for the Republican Party against the Jewish vote for the Democrats. It was actually shut up on a State Department record. We had some Australian files that were tabled in Parliament down there, and it was Nixon's State Department said that Yeah, the Americans know where the Nazi bases are in America, but they're keeping quiet about it because it's important to get out the ethnic vote in five key states.
And this is in the 50s when he was vice president?
Yep. And because that's when the immigration occurred. The Justice Department, there was a right. new legislation in 53, the Refugee Relief Act.
And the first year, right, of the Eisenhower.
Yeah. Forbidding the entry of to anyone in America who is a supporter of a totalitarian government. Right? The Justice Department.
John, I'm sorry, we have to cut to a little break right now. We are speaking with John Loftus about his amazing discoveries when he worked for the Department of Justice and his book, America's Nazi Secret, here on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Gallup is out with brand new poll results on Americans' attitudes towards the Middle East, and some of the numbers are not good at all. Remember back in October of last year when former President Trump warned American Jews they had better get their act together and realize what they have in Israel before it's too late, noting that evangelical support for the Jewish state outpaced that of Jews in America. For that legitimate concern, Trump was labeled an anti-Semite by the ADL, the White House, and media. Of course he was. The aforementioned groups are made up mostly of Democrats, and Gallup has found that Democrats sympathize more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% to 38%. That's an 11-point increase in Democrat support for the Palestinians in the past year. And to Trump's point, it's worth noting that some 70% of Jews in America lean Democrat. Independents are more sympathetic to Israel, 49 to 32%, but that's up 6 points for the Palestinians. Republicans, they're 80% to 11% in favor of Israel. Overall, the Palestinians register a new high of 31% support, while the 54% of Americans sympathizing more with the Israelis, that's the lowest since 2005. And you can thank the Dems and the biased anti-Israel media for those numbers. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
For many people with debt problems, the first time they can sleep without worry is when they've talked to us. At Step Change Debt Charity, our free advice helps thousands of people every week get their finances back on track. If you need help, contact us and take the first step to a debt-free future. Step Change Debt Charity. Free debt advice. Life-changing debt solutions.
Visit stepchange.org to find out more. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
The conversation continues with Bruce DeTorres on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
With us is John Loftus talking about the amazing Nazi files he found in the bowels of the archives and records back when he worked for the Justice Department, and how Richard Nixon, as a young naval officer, basically blackmailed the Dulles brothers for support to become a congressman, then a senator, and then vice president. John, if you've got the next part of the story, great. If not, I've got some other questions. What should we discuss now?
Well, I just wanted to finish up something about the Justice Department were the accomplices to Nixon, Vice President Nixon, and to Eisenhower, and the Dulles brothers in hiding the stuff. So Congress passes a law trying to keep Nazis out. 1953, no one who supports totalitarian government could come in. The Justice Department then, Eisenhower's appointees, and secretly interpret that law to bar only people who advocate a totalitarian government in the United States. So they turned the law on its head, but it's there in the books. So years later, when we're assigned to prosecute Nazi war criminals again, we can't get them under this law because it's only interpreted by justice to mean we will only go against Nazis, people who advocate a Nazi government for America. So that lets everybody off the hook. So it was a farce.
Yeah.
I couldn't. So my job then was to try and find out. My boss was a former Nuremberg prosecutor. He said, "We got to find out what's going on." So I began reporting only to him. Of course, he was quickly driven out of the Justice Department with a series of smear stories in the press. So
Why was he squeezed out?
Maybe trying to find out what was going on. You know,
Right. Okay.
And you know, we knew that the Eisenhower's attorney general had done some very nasty things. And there had to be a better explanation. How could these Nazis not only get inside the United States, but mm-hmm. be able to stay here for decades without any of them being prosecuted? And that's when we begin to realize that there's this massive cover-up.
You know, in our remaining time, John, we can talk about more that you've found along those lines, the Department of Justice, and or something really interesting is the Vatican's role as a conduit, money launderer, blah, 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 during the war, after the war. But then I definitely want to save plenty of time to talk about what you decided to do to bring this public, how you got on 60 Minutes, and then everything that you've discovered, and you know, since. So,
yeah. You know, that's actually a good place to start, because, you know, when I'm down in these underground vaults, and I'm coming across horrendous stuff like the memoirs of a Jewish guy, Saul Shinato, who fought against the communists and the Nazis, came to America to find freedom, and ended up living in New Jersey less than a half an hour away from the people that murdered his family. And, you know, the State Department classified it, hit it down the nuclear vaults. I thought, what a tragedy. Guy comes to America to find freedom, ends up living in the shadow of his killers. So I wrote out a manuscript of what had happened, and I dedicated it to Saul, a Jew who bore witness to the Holocaust, and to Meg, my newborn, so that she may never have to. And I gave it to this government and said, I want to declassify this. And I want to go public. So the CIA was assigned to coordinate the censorship. And I did censor some things out, but an awful lot of people in the U.S. government were on my side. They wanted the story told. So I got permission from CIA on behalf of all the federal agencies to go public. And what do you do when you want to go public in America? I called 60 Minutes, who had already been tipped off by the CIA. And Mike gave me two segments on the show, double segments. It was the longest they'd ever done up to that point. And
Mike
won
Wallace.
The Emmy Award. Mike Wallace. Yeah, he got the Emmy Award in 1982. Congress did investigations, and my family got the death threats. It was a great trade-off. Hmm. But the 60 Minutes show caused a firestorm. Congress did demand hearings. And then another cover-up began. The Barry Goldwater and the other Republican leaders put pressure on the Democratic chair of the Immigration Subcommittee. And he was told, if you don't hold public hearings, we will make sure that no Republican will ever run against you for Congress. And he was really worried at that time about that. So he agreed. And they did little things like, they only notified me of the hearings. They delayed the hearings for 3 years. And then notified me like 48 hours in advance the hearings would be coming up. So that's how much time I had to write my statement. And, but it was a farce. It was just a farce. So that's how long the cover-up lasted. 1985, the congressional hearings were a joke.
Right, because you were on 60 Minutes in 82.
Right. And then 3 years before they would hold hearings. Then what I did was team up with Mark Ahrens, my friend from Australia, and we did a book. Because the Vatican stuff had been censored out of the Belarus Secret, my first book. The first book, by the way, The Belarus Secret, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize by the Alfred Knopf Publishers. And
nice.
So it's now reprinted as part of America's Nazi Secret by Trinday. So America's Nazi Secret, the next step was Mark and I went to work on the Vatican. That had been censored out. The Vatican had set up a team of crooked fascist priests to give out phony passports, religious passports, if you will, to smuggle the Nazis to South America. Horrible, but it happened.
And, right at the end of the war? Right at the end of the war?
Yeah. And they went out by the tens of thousands. And, you know, we tried to
South
shut
America.
It down.
Yeah.
My friend, American Counterintelligence Corps, was going to have a raid and grab a very large war criminal. He was the head of the fascist government of Croatia. And the State Department sent him a note, hands off. All right, so Yeah, we were,
right.
Our State Department was protecting Nazis. They were more loyal to the Dulles brothers' clients than they were to President Truman and President Roosevelt.
Well, so, and I want to just comment on a couple of quick things. Tens of thousands of Nazis to South America. That is a large thing for people to hear for the first time. But I heard Chris Milligan talking to one of his authors, John, it might have been you, about these things, where Chris related the story he heard about a drug smuggler or maybe a CIA guy in the 1980s around that whole, you know, Contra, all those shenanigans. But here's the anecdote I remember, that this guy came back and he was basically shell-shocked. And the thing that had stunned him was in the woods doing his smuggling, you know, scary, very dangerous. You don't know who to trust. He came back and he said he stumbled upon Nazi troops in full uniform in the 1980s. Were they doing some drills? Were they representing some faction down there? Does that ring a bell, that story?
No, that doesn't, but it doesn't surprise me. There were certain places like Ciudad in the northwest corner of Argentina that was just a Nazi colony. I mean, it looked like something out of the Swiss Alps. And there were certain bases like that where the Nazis were relocated. It was just a fact. I did a show with ABC where I identified the top Nazi war criminal in Rome who had conducted a major massacre. And he was living openly. So we exposed him on ABC. The uproar caused him to be extradited to Italy, where he stood trial and was convicted to a life sentence. That he had buddies still marching around in uniform doesn't surprise me. A lot of the Latin American security services hired ex-SS guys as their security staff. The French hired one entire SS division and sent them to French Vietnam. So the joke was, this was Himmler's last stand at the Battle of Yen Bien Phu. So, yeah, everyone thought that these former Nazis could be recruited to fight the communists. Big joke. They were already working for the communists. It was a tragedy. But it really, I think of all the American soldiers coming back after World War II that couldn't find jobs in this country, and we were giving taxpayer-funded jobs away to Nazi propagandists to work for Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe. And, they absolutely betrayed us. All our security was a joke. The Cold War dragged on for years because all the innocent people behind the Iron Curtain who wanted to help America and be liberated from communism, they were all being betrayed.
This is Bruce Tatarus. We were talking with John Loftus, author of America's Nazi Secret. Just an amazing book, an amazing story. It's available at trineday.com. And I was truly fascinated by one of his anecdotes about how Richard Nixon blackmailed the Dulles brothers in order to get their support in launching a political career. And he obviously wrote that too. And he was also foisted on Eisenhower to be his running mate in 1952. And the skullduggery, the criminality of the Department of Justice, as John was describing, reminded me how they stonewalled the recommendation from the House Select Committee in the late 1970s, recommending to the Justice Department to further investigate the Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations. That was the official conclusion of the House committee at the end of the 1970s. And 3 or 4 years later, in 1983, the Department of Justice said, we don't agree with your analysis of the acoustic evidence, so we're disregarding the conclusion that there were probably more than one shooter. And it was another 5 years later that they issued a memo to someone related to the case. Upon our study, we don't see a need to reinvestigate either assassination. So, real history, the likes of which are found in John Loftus's book, America's Nazi Secret, And frankly, all the books at TryAndDate.com can set us free. And when enough of us know what's really going on here in America, enough of us will pressure our representatives to work for us and to flush the corruption out of the system and account to us with transparency and honesty so that we have a prayer of self-governing with representatives working for us for our benefit and not that of corporations. This is TNT Radio.